Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Today we're going to be in conversation about women in history, and specifically about women in ancient history. My guest for this is Dr. Daisy Dunn. Dr. Daisy Dunn is an award-winning classicist, author of a number of books, including her latest. It's called The Missing Thread, A Woman's History of the Ancient World. Daisy Dunn, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Oh, me too. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you.
You have three lines in your introduction that I just found fascinating. I want to quote them, and I should probably warn everybody that they're kind of intense, and it's an intense subject. Usually I like to begin a conversation by, like, you know, how are you? Interesting weather we're having. So, but I'm just going to get right into this because it really piqued my interest. And you write this: in Ovid's Metamorphoses, and Ovid was an ancient Roman poet, lived about 2,000 years ago. You write, in Ovid's Metamorphoses, Philomela weaves the story of her rape into a tapestry after her tongue is cut out and she is deprived of the power of speech. It did not always occur to men that real women might be up to something just as interesting. These women are the focus of this book. And again, the book is called The Missing Thread. And I just sort of, maybe I'm stretching here, but I kind of attach, The Missing Thread and the story of Philomela sort of suddenly made sense, where you have to really look within, I guess, the threads to find the stories of women in the ancient world.
You absolutely do. I mean, I think I actually took a while to think of a really good title for this book, because originally I wanted to have some powerful Latin word or two words or phrase. And actually, I found that most of the kind of recognizable words had already been taken by other books. So I was thinking, goodness, what am I going to do? And then I just sat down to think about what had I actually been going through while I was researching this book. It took me many, many years to research. And I realized that I felt almost like these women in the ancient world who were all weavers, by the way. That was the sort of the principal occupation of most women in the ancient world. They had to stay at home and weave. And I've never done any weaving in my life. I've done a little bit of knitting, but no weaving. But I felt sort of metaphorically a little bit like them, because I was having to be incredibly patient. I was having to comb through a lot of evidence, sift through all the different sources to try and find what women were actually up to in the ancient world, because this is the big curiosity for me. We have all of these fantastic plays, which are still being performed today, many of them. We have novels that are being written, and they are typically novels where people are taking mythological women and retelling their stories. But actually, historical women, women who actually existed, have been rather neglected over time. And that is partly because they are so difficult to find. So I was having to pick them out and weave together their stories on some giant kind of loom, which I guess would be my laptop, to find a modern comparison, and try and pull together the story, the different threads of this story. And I hope that's what I've managed to do.
And Philomela, am I saying Philomela correctly?
Yeah, Philomela or Philomela, it doesn't really matter.
Uh-huh. This is a mythological character?
This is a mythological character. The Metamorphoses of Ovid was this great epic in 15 books that were written down, where people typically change form and change shape, largely because of the gods changing their fate and what happened to them. And Philomela was someone who really suffered as a result of the behaviour of men. And she was deprived of her power of speech quite literally by having her tongue cut out. But it's kind of, this story is like many myths, it's allegorical. I mean, a lot of women did not have the power of speech. They might literally have a tongue, but they didn't have any public voice. And I think this is almost what Ovid was getting at. In the poem, you know, a lot of women are there in society, but they don't have a public voice. And that was true in his society, and it was certainly true back in ancient Greece as well.
What we know about women from the ancient world mostly comes from writings from men, I imagine. Like,
It does. This is the really difficult thing, because we know that women were writing poetry a lot of the time. Women were even writing books of history, but people just didn't bother to preserve their work. Nearly all the work we have is written by men, so we have to be really reliant on these sources by men in order to understand what women were doing. And obviously that's hugely problematic, because men are very, very biased. They could be very judgmental against women who dared to do anything that was considered sort of beyond their ken. And as a historian, you're having to sort of sift through their judgment process and thinking, actually, what's behind this? Why are they presenting these women in this way? You come across certain tropes which are repeated again and again and again. And as a historian myself, I kind of found it really, really important to combine these men's bits of writing with archaeological evidence as well, because that can really bolster the picture. It can challenge what's been written down as well. So you have to take a sort of 360-degree view of the evidence by looking at lots and lots of different types. And then I think you start to get round this problem of the fact that so much of the material is actually written by men.
Do you find that Ovid, if I recall correctly, sort of the poet of love of the ancient world, that Ovid was sensitive in his
I think,
description of women?
yeah, I mean, Ovid is really, really interesting as a poet. So he's living in the 1st century BC, right, really at the very beginning of the Roman Empire. And he, in his early poetry, he was writing a lot about women. I mean, he was writing his first work was the Amores, and these are essentially love poems, and they are very touching, they're very romantic, they're very sentimental, some of them aren't, some of them are very, very explicit and sort of sexually quite ripe. But then he went on to write a book called The Heroides, and these are actually essentially love letters by mythological women to the men who have usually wronged them. And that's quite something to imagine, a Roman man literally placing himself in the shoes of a woman who's been wronged and trying to imagine exactly how she felt. So, of all the poets, Ovid is one of my favourites, because he does seem to actually have some interest and some concern for how women might feel a lot of the time. And that's not something you typically find in the society in which he's living. People are very, very stoic. We think of stoicism, that's a great sort of Roman virtue. Men are encouraged to be strong. And it's this kind of stiff upper lip idea that we have in Britain is kind of existing in ancient Rome as well. But Ovid and the kind of the poets with whom he associated were a lot more free, and they love this idea of being completely enthralled to a powerful, domineering kind of has negative connotations, but I mean this in a kind of a way that these women that they fell in love with seem to have absolute control over them. So they kind of flip the narrative of what the reality usually was.
And Philomela, and we're going to get into the real women in a moment of the ancient world, but the story of Philomela is just profound. She's raped, I believe, by her sister's husband. Her tongue is cut out, so she could not speak about it, and she weaves it into, I guess, a tapestry, and her story of her rape into the tapestry. And as you were mentioning earlier, that was like one of the biggest occupation of women in the ancient world, was weaving, and just sort of it's a pretty profound story. Was it common to tell stories through weaving?
Well, we find in if you go back to Homer, right at the beginning of the written literature that we have from the Western world, the Iliad and the Odyssey began life as oral poems, and then they were written down. And we find within these really early poems a reference to Helen of Troy weaving. We can imagine, I mean, she seems to be sort of weaving the story of the war, which she allegedly caused, you know, into a tapestry. We find her almost being the poet herself of the poem in which she features. It's kind of quite meta, this idea, and it's very, very early. We're thinking about around 8th century BC. So this idea that women could be weaving not just purely to make clothes or, you know, in a kind of functional sense, but actually in a more creative sense, that really appealed to people. Whether this is actually true in reality, it's probably less so. I think women a lot of the time were making clothes. They were making funeral shrouds. In the Odyssey, we get Penelope making famously this great shroud for her father-in-law for when he dies. And in that case, it's not really the picture, it's not the story that matters. It's what she does with it. She unpicks the threads of this tapestry that she creates every night. So she actually undoes her own handiwork so that she can put off this dreaded day where she has to remarry. Her husband is still absent. He's still making his way home from the Trojan War, but nobody knows that for sure. And she's under huge pressure to marry one of these suitors who've taken up residence in his palace where she's still living on the island of Ithaca. So she has this very clever ruse of undoing her weaving. So all through history, and particularly within this early literature, you have this really central idea of women doing something with their weaving. You know, it might be seen as a chore, but at the same time, they could get creative with it. And I really like that idea to apply it to more broadly to women's lives. You know, to me, it didn't really matter whether real women were doing similar things with their weaving or not. I think as a metaphor, it still holds this idea that women in society were doing all kinds of interesting things secretly, like Penelope unpicking her threads. But a lot of the time, men just had absolutely no idea what it was that they were doing.
And this is where my ignorance is going to really show. Is it possible for something that was weaved, say, 2,000 years ago to still exist today, to still be found? Or would it?
It's incredibly rare that we find woven fabrics from the ancient world. They do not, they're not preserved very well at all. You have some examples of fabrics, and that's typically where they've been preserved in something like the permafrost. So if you think about, there's a tribe of people known as the Scythians who lived around the Eurasian steppe, so quite near the Black Sea. In this vast area, sort of partly around Siberia, it gets very, very cold there. And we have sort of certain bits of fabric that have been preserved because of those extremely cold temperatures. But for the most part, when we're talking about the ancient world, I study Greece and Rome, these are not good conditions for preserving fabric.
I just imagine so much loss then, not being able to access that. So sort of
So much.
their own form of documents, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's such a, all that work that women did, you know, has largely vanished. But I mean, the good thing, at least, is that we have some idea of what it looked like, because vase paintings often preserve images of woven objects, woven garments. So you can see, for example, funeral shrouds over the dead painted onto early Greek vase paintings. So we have an idea of the kind of patterns and things that were popular at different times in history. So we have an idea of, you know, of what women were actually putting on to these designs. But the actual originals themselves have, in most cases, disappeared.
One more thing here about mythology, because you mentioned Homer, and you write that it has been commonly believed, though I think now when we think about Homer, who you know is credited with writing the Iliad and the Odyssey, of not being one person, but these stories coming from an oral tradition that eventually were written down. But it was believed, and maybe there's still, well, you'll tell me where this stands now, that Homer first got these stories from a woman, Fantasia.
This is the most fascinating thing, which I actually didn't know about until I started researching this book, that there's this idea that Homer, this great genius, everyone accepts that Homer is this genius in ancient history, that he actually plagiarized the work of a woman. And it was a woman called Fantasia who actually came up with the stories of the Iliad and the Odyssey in the first place. And she had them written down and she deposited them in a temple in Egypt. And then this Homer came along and took them and used them and created his own work and got all the fame and the praise from it. And it's quite extraordinary. And you find references to this woman and her work in some of these great scholars who were working in the Library of Alexandria, this great center of learning. And so therefore you kind of take it, you think, gosh, goodness, that is there something to this? And down history, certainly modern writers have been quite interested in the idea that Fantasia might have been the true author of the Homeric epics. You find For example, Robert Graves, most famous for I, Claudius, he was completely convinced by this, that he said, well, the Odyssey is very much the kind of work that a woman might have composed. It's quite sort of female-centric, Penelope, lots of key female characters, and it seems more female than it does male. But the sort of the disappointing thing is the truth is kind of staring you in the face, because fantasia is a word that means fantasy or sort of affront or a fabrication, and this is exactly what it is. This is a great sort of literary hoax that lasted through and was believed by people and recorded as if it is fact. It was actually one of these scholars at the Library of Alexandria who really kind of played around with this idea. He loved kind of inventing things and making up evidence, and he was kind of quite mischievous as well as being probably quite a clever man, and people fell for it. But I just think there's something quite key and quite sort of interesting about that, the idea that a woman might have been behind the Homeric epics to some extent, because as you say, the Iliad and the Odyssey had this really, really long history. We don't know who Homer was, whether Homer was one person or more likely, more people believe several people, because of this great oral culture. People are singing the poems, they're recording them by remembering them, by performing them. They're being passed down from generation to generation, and they're changing along the time, all the time. So, quite possibly some of the people in that long chain of process were women who were recording the stories as well. So it's very, very difficult to say that there's no sort of female involvement in the history of Homer. I certainly like to think that there was some.
The Library of Alexandria is important in understanding classical history, especially from ancient Greece and Rome and Egypt. Alexandria's in Egypt. This is a library that was really sort of responsible for helping us finally get these pieces of works from the ancient world that we still have today, sort of a nexus in between. You said there were women scholars within this library?
There were women scholars all through history, in the library itself, and the majority of the official kind of employees would have been male, but certainly there would have been associates with them who were a lot more sort of freer in their activity. But we just don't know very, very much about these kind of women who might have been kind of on the periphery of that. I mean, what we do know when we think about this great library was that it was burned down by Julius Caesar and the Romans when they came over. So actually a huge amount of this learning and the sort of the origins of the people who were there was absolutely decimated, absolutely destroyed in this devastating fire. So it's really sad, actually. We know certainly the names of some female historians in time, but we don't have any of their work at all. So it's a real pity, but I can't. I'm very clear sort of in the book. I don't want to sort of give a false impression that women were there right at the centre, working in the library, working in all these places as sort of central people. I think a lot of the time they would have been very much in private and having to sort of produce their work away from men in a very different kind of manner, because it wasn't accepted for women to be within the company of men very often.
There is one woman from the ancient world where we do have her writings. That's Sappho. Who
Yes.
was Sappho?
Sappho was this remarkable poet who was living on the island of Lesbos, the Greek island of Lesbos, in the 7th century BC. And she came from probably what was quite a noble family. And she worked as almost like a headmistress of a school for girls, but it's a specific type of school. It was a school that specialized in music and poetry. And we describe her as being a lyric poet because she performed her poetry to the accompaniment of music. And this is typically music performed by the lyre. And the lyre was this ancient instrument which, at its most basic at this time, it probably would have consisted of a tortoise shell with strings strung across it. And those strings would have been made from the intestines of a sheep, usually. So quite a kind of rudimentary instrument. And she composed songs for performance. She took place in competitions. She taught girls to compose and perform their work as well. So she was a really, really interesting character, and she's become most famous for the poems that she wrote for other women. She was certainly very admiring of other women. She could be very, very jealous of people. And quite a few fragments of her work have been preserved, and this is remarkable. I mean, most of them have been dug up from one town in Egypt, the Oxyrhynchus, which translates as the town of the sharp-nosed fish. So I love that name. This fantastic trove of material. And I say trove, I mean, a lot of it is missing still. It's quite frustrating when you're handling Sappho's work because you have huge gaps. You can have a word like sea and then a huge gap and then wind and then a huge gap. And you have to kind of use your imagination as to what might have possibly have been in those blanks. But you certainly get an idea of her as a character and you get an idea of the status that she held in antiquity as well, because you have a lot of men who'd actually seen a lot more of her work than we have, saying that she was absolutely remarkable, that she was the best female poet that had ever lived, you know, that she was almost the female equivalent of Homer. So I think we have to kind of take their judgment on that when we don't have as much information as we'd like. But certainly those fragments do tell a story. And we have fragments by some other women as well, who were clearly often inspired by Sappho. And when I was writing my book, I thought it's really important that we have some of those women's voices directly on the page. So I actually translated different fragments of these women's work and I put them at the head of each chapter in my book, just so you can kind of see, you know, these are the words that we have by women. And, you know, some of them are absolutely beautiful and stunning.
So we have the poetry of Sappho, but we also have other writings from other people about Sappho as well.
We do, yes. We have poets of listing her as being among the nine great female poets who ever existed. We have a geographer in Strabo writing about her centuries later, about her being absolutely remarkable. And we have sort of, again, so within probably a century or 2 centuries of her being alive, we have vase paintings which purport to be of her, and they show her often with a male poet who also lived on the island of Lesbos called Alcaeus. And certain inventions were made up. So there's this great love story that was written as if she and Alcaeus were having some kind of relationship, which is extremely unlikely. And you get kind of weird writings cropping up in the ancient world as well. You get men who could not possibly have ever seen her or met her because they were living a long time later, saying that she was very small, she was very unattractive, but you know, she was a good poet. And so you have to really look as a historian very carefully at the dates of all of these writers that you're handling, because a lot of the time their testimony is just not particularly useful to us because it's so far removed in time and in value.
And you said Sappho writes admiringly of women. Are they love poems?
They are love poems, yes. She writes really admiringly of, so the sensations you can get when you see someone. She writes this really beautiful poem about sort of how sort of faint and how jealous she feels when she watches a woman that she admires being admired by somebody else across the room. And she has the whole, so the physical sensation of, you know, almost like your mouth drying up, you can't say anything, you've got sort of this feeling under your skin, and it's very sort of a visceral type of poem. And centuries later, you get a Roman poet, Catullus, translating it into Latin. So that's quite interesting. You get sort of the women's poem being translated by a man to describe his jealousy when he sees another man admiring a woman that he loves. So this is a poem that really kind of stood the test of time. Centuries later, Lord Byron, the poet, would also translate it. So it's clearly one of those kind of very, very timeless verses which has been carried forward all the way from Sappho back in the 7th century BC.
And one of your previous books was on Catullus.
Exactly, yes. Absolutely love Catullus. I say I love Ovid, I love Catullus as well. My first book was on this remarkable love poet, Catullus, who was living in the 1st century BC. And, you know, he was also a true romantic. And I think he understood to a degree what it was like to be a woman as well. He often kind of phrased his poems from the viewpoint of a woman sort of wounded. He talks particularly about my favorite poem. I call it the bedspread poem because it describes this amazing embroidery, again, weaving on a marriage couch, this incredible sort of coverlet that's laid on this bed. And he describes the design upon it. And this design features Ariadne, who was the half sister of the Minotaur, mythological figure in Crete. And he creates this whole sort of speech for Ariadne and how absolutely devastated and heartbroken she is when her lover Theseus decides to just depart. She's actually helped him to navigate the labyrinth, kill the Minotaur, this half bull, half man beast who her mother had conceived. And she helped him, she gave him the thread that let him out of the labyrinth. And then he loved her and left her, he just abandoned her. And then she has this remarkable speech saying, you must never trust a man. All men are traitors. It seems very, very modern. It's the kind of thing you'd read today. And it seems like something you could find on the internet. It really is that modern.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Dr. Daisy Dunn. Daisy Dunn's award-winning classicist and author of the book, The Missing Thread, A Woman's History of the Ancient World. I could do a whole hour on Sappho now after just the back and forward there. And I'm going to move on in a moment here, but one last question on Sappho. Sappho is from the island of Lesbos. Is this the etymology of the word lesbian?
Yes, so she's known in antiquity as the lesbian poet because she came from the island of Lesbos. But it was really sort of in the 19th century that you get the word lesbian used to describe love between women. But even in antiquity, there was some kind of suggestion of this because there's a Greek verb, an ancient Greek verb, lesbiazein, which described a certain kind of sexual activity. So there's a kind of idea that Lesbos itself was an island in which subversive love kind of reigns supreme, and this idea is kind of circulating antiquity. But the idea of lesbianism and the vocabulary of it really arrived in the 19th century, so quite a lot later. But with reference to Sappho, Sapphism, same thing, directly relevant to her.
Let me ask about another woman that you write about, Aspasia. And if I mispronounce any of these names, you'll let us know. Aspasia was a wife of Pericles, who was the leader of Athens during sort of the height, the golden era of ancient democracy in Athens, also known as a teacher. Oh, I've heard her described as a teacher to Socrates, the Western world's greatest philosopher. Tell me more about Aspasia.
Aspasia or Aspasia, she was a most amazing character, real historical woman, as you say. She became the, we don't know if it's technically wife or we might say common law wife. She's certainly the long-term partner of Pericles, who was the general who was really admired for being the great sort of architect of democracy in ancient Athens. And Pericles as a character was interesting. So he divorced his first wife, by whom he had two children. He met Aspasia and lived with her. And yet he said, he's one of the speeches that's attributed to him, he said that great is the glory of the woman who is least spoken about, whether for good or for ill. And yet Aspasia was one of the most outspoken women that we have on record in ancient Athens, because as you say, she entered the circle of Socrates. She was admired for being a great public speaker. People who were learning to be orators would go and listen to her speak. I mean, this must have been so rare in Athens. And I say that because women in Athens, in the state, we're talking about the 5th century BC, were some of the most sheltered of the women in history. They typically didn't really even leave the house very much. Aspasia was allowed to do that. She was allowed to circulate and to mix with men and to attend their symposia or their drinks party because she came from outside of Athens. She grew up in a place called Miletus, which is now part of what's Turkey today. And it was very much so if you're a woman growing up outside of Athens, you had a much bigger opportunity in some of these city states to receive an education than you would if you had been born an Athenian citizen. So she came and brought her learning. She was probably about 20 years old when she moved to Athens. And she was immediately recognized for being very, very clever and very, very eloquent. And she's described a lot of, in a lot of the sources as being a hetaira, which is a type of courtesan in the ancient world. And it's specifically a type of courtesan who was admired for her education, for her skills, for she was a very highly kind of educated type of prostitute, as opposed to a pornare, as another description of a prostitute who had been a more affordable prostitute. And these were not prostitutes in the sense that you'd pay for sort of discreet services by these women. These were more women you had long-term relationships with in Athens. So the life of the hetaira, I think, in Athens, Aspasia, if she was indeed a hetaira, on the one hand, it's grim. You know, you've got no sort of choice over your body and so much else. On the other hand, you've got a lot more physical freedom than the women around you, by which I mean the ability to go to the theatre, to go out in public, to attend these evenings and parties, and to talk about politics, to talk about whatever you really wanted to talk about. And this is a right that was denied other women. And Aspasia really kind of capitalizes on this. And I think partly as a result of that, there's a certain degree of resentment towards her from the broader population of Athens. Pericles himself is criticized for packing on too much PDA, I think would be the modern phrase, too much sort of public display of affection. He was said to be rather too kind of schmaltzy with her. He was kissing her goodbye in the morning. This was not a kind of very respectable thing for a man of his station to do. And Aspasia herself, when Pericles, was sort of fighting wars and they were not going his way, people would blame Aspasia. They'd say it was her idea for this particular invasion to take place. Clearly, it's her fault. So I think if you were a woman and you were in the public eye, which was so rare in that period, you had it both ways. Certainly, a lot of blame was laid at your door.
Do we have a full accounting of her story?
We have various sources here and there. So she's better recorded than a lot of other women because she was clearly prominent. And this is a time in Athens's history where we have quite a lot of information. But we don't have sort of like one great, huge, overarching sort of biography of her that we might like to have. There are so many sort of unanswered questions. I'd love to know so much more about her background and, you know, the kind of learning that she achieved. What kind of an orator was she? You know, what did Socrates really value about her? But there was clearly something remarkable about her, the fact that men were actually being told to study her, to learn from her as a woman. This is almost unheard of in ancient Greece.
And this gets back to your point, right? The missing thread. You're looking for these threads that are missing and trying to find these stories and tell these stories.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. I think I have so many sort of history books at home, and they say, well, this is the story, this is the history of the ancient world. And you get the same kind of timeline. The timeline kind of doesn't really change very much. You get, you know, Persian War, Peloponnesian War, a whole list of sort of wars and rulers. And that's fine. But you don't get sort of how women were contributing to all of these events. And women clearly were involved in absolutely everything that happened, just as they are today. I mean, you can't subtract half of the population and pretend that they weren't there. They were there. So their thread is one that I want to kind of pick out and bring to the very front of the narrative. I don't try to pretend in this book that women were ruling the world, that they were making all of the key decisions, and that all these great events that we read about in Greece were dependent upon their actions. You know, that wasn't the case. What I try to do is to push the men slightly to the side in order to bring to the focus what the women were actually doing, what role did they have in each of these very important battles, events, everything else that's going on.
I very much want to ask you about Cornelia. Cornelia, this is ancient Rome. This is time of the Roman Republic before the onset of the empire, but towards the end of the Republic. This is a very volatile political moment. Sometimes our own political situation today here in the United States is compared to this period of time, which was like a 100-year civil war in ancient Rome at the end of the Republic. But Cornelia is the mother of the Gracchi brothers, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchi. And these were two political figures who, I guess we could say, were populists of their day in trying to deal with such things as debt and inequality in ancient Rome. They would be assassinated in trying to overturn sort of the political system at the time. You could probably explain all that better than I can, but tell me what's important to know about Cornelia, again, who's the mother of the Gracchi brothers.
I think that's really well put. It is a really, really febrile time. These brothers grow up and they are tremendous populists. And I think what's really interesting about them is the fact that they are raised predominantly by their mother, Cornelia, because their father dies while she's still in her 30s. We're told that she actually had 12 children. We don't know whether that means that she delivered all 12 or whether she conceived 12, but only three in any case survived, and the two brothers and a sister, Sempronia, are the ones who survived. So she actually masterminded their education. She taught them Latin, she taught them some Greek, she employed the best tutors around. And it was believed in antiquity that their eloquence, the eloquence that these two boys would need in order to become such successful populists, actually originated with her. And she was really admired as a result of that, and also for her strength of spirit. I mean, she's someone we actually have some writing by, and said how rare this is to find writing by women. We have part of a letter that she wrote to her younger son, Gaius, to try to deter him from following in his brother's footsteps and becoming this great kind of popular politician. What these brothers were doing was really antagonizing the traditional elite of Rome, the senatorial class, who wanted everything to stay exactly as it had been for hundreds of years. These brothers wanted to shake things up, and it was seen to be incredibly dangerous what they wanted to do. They were standing for office, a particular office, more times than was actually strictly allowed. And by doing that, they incurred the frustration and the envy of the senatorial class. And Cornelia, having lost one son to this event, the eldest son Tiberius, she obviously wanted to deter Gaius from following the footsteps and doing exactly the same thing. And this letter is quite strongly worded, so much so that some people have suspected it must be a forgery. I don't think that. If it is a forgery, the consensus is it's an ancient forgery, not a modern one. But these writings to me look just like the kind of thing a mother would say to her son. It's full of anxiety. It's full of grief. She's saying, can you not at least wait until I've died before you, if you must do this? Like, why won't you take any pity on me? I'm growing old. Please, I can't. You can't do this to me, is essentially what she's saying in her letter, while expressing solidarity with his desires. And she understands what he's trying to do. He wants to avenge the death of his brother. He's hopeful that he can do the same thing, but he is assassinated as well. And Cornelia is astonishing because she carries on. I mean, people look at her. She moves out of Rome. She takes up residence of this enormous villa that she had towards the bits of Bay of Naples. And she lived there, she had dignitaries come and pay her court, foreign kings. She had a kind of almost like a literary salon going on, and she lived into her 80s. So she was a remarkably strong woman, and she was really admired for that. And she was actually honored with statues as being the mother of the Gracchi. And to be honored with a statue in the ancient world was also quite a rare thing.
And she had literary salons happening.
She did. And this is, again, really surprising. It sort of shows us the fact that she herself was highly educated. She was really interested, I think, in, we don't know exactly what her reading was, but she seems to have been very interested in philosophy, in Greek literature as well. And she had people to come and stay. And she seems to have hosted these tremendous parties. She's even said at one point to have turned down an offer of marriage from a Ptolemy in Egypt. And he had a nickname of Fat Face. And I quite like the idea that maybe she was put off by that. But in either case, she rejected him. And she decided she'd actually wanted to remain a woman on her own. She wanted to remain widowed. She never wanted to remarry again. And usually women in Rome were under huge pressure to remarry. There's a rule, certainly, so the law that comes in says that women could remarry or should remarry after 10 months of mourning. I mean, that was the sort of standard. There'd be a lot of pressure on you if you were of childbearing age to still remarry and start a new family. But she was actually respected and carrying on in her own right. And she seems to have been tremendously independent and financially independent, as well as sort of in every other regard. It
goes without saying she influenced Tiberius and Gaius Gracchi, but not all children share their parents' politics. Do we know of her politics?
Well, in this letter that we have, so the only thing we have in her hand, she says, you know, we don't want you to ruin the Republic. But it's a fair thing to try and take revenge on your enemies. So we have an idea that she is in sympathy with her son, but at the same time, she doesn't want the whole of the political system overhauled by a member of her own family, at least. And I think, you know, this is a really difficult time politically. I mean, the Republic would rumble on for another half century or so. So, you know, it's nearing the end, the Roman Republic, but it's still going to keep going for a little while. And why her sons are so sort of influential is they really kind of set a new standard. There's no going back to this old senatorial elite where they kind of go unchallenged, bidding the seats of power again and again and again. You get more and more populists emerging. So sort of in the next decades, you get Sulla and Marius, and you get this sort of whole new era of civil war, which will then be sort of repeated. You'll get sort of Julius Caesar coming into the action as well. And all of these populists whose names have been recorded down history. And I like to place really sort of Cornelia at the beginning of that process as being someone who was recognized for being incredibly intelligent and influential to the sons that she raised.
I saw an article that you wrote a few years ago that's online. It's at the New Statesman concerning Republic. And of course, right now we're living in a time in which we are living in a republic, and we're wondering what's the state of our own republic. And this article, you'll forgive me, I should have had it down here in my notes, but I did go back and read it. It's a column that you write that, what is it? A republic is really just an ideal.
This is interesting. Yeah.
Is any of that making sense? I'm doing this right off the top of my head. So,
yes, yeah, no. So this is an idea, and I think this is something that's kind of borne out when you look into the people who were ruling the Republic. Certainly, when it was on its last legs, the Romans created this Republic after being ruled by kings, and it was seen to be of just absolute significance, absolute importance to them, that they would never ever return to any kind of autocracy or dictatorship or any kind of one-man rule ever again. This idea of having a republic was so important, and this is, if you read the works of Cicero, you'll understand exactly how important the concept, the ideal of a republic is. This is where you get this ideal of a republic idea coming through, is through the works of Cicero. In particular, Cicero is not willing to believe that the Republic is really under threat at all, even when it's very, very clear that it's the whole of the Roman Empire is basically growing. Rome and its sort of environs are becoming, it's just too unwieldy a system. And more people are emerging to the fore to try and capitalize upon the weaknesses, the cracks that are appearing within that republic. But Cicero would actually give his life to preserve it. And this is what we find during the Catilinarian conspiracy, one of these terrifying conspiracies, which was rumored to be aimed at bringing the Republic to an end, to completely overhauling government and bringing in, you know, some kind of new order of things. It was actually quelled as a conspiracy, but it reverberated right the way through history, and it might have cost Cicero his life had he not been told of the intelligence of the plot, actually by a woman called Fulvia, who I discuss in my book. Again, her part's usually played down within the history of these events. But certainly, I think by this point in the history of Rome, it's very, very clear that the Republic is an ideal, and there are people who are absolutely desperate to cling on to it. But there's also this recognition that it can no longer function in the way that it always had done before. And what I find particularly interesting is, even after it's gone, when you've got the first emperors ruling Rome, you know, this thing which the Romans thought would never ever happen again, as soon as the first few emperors die, there seems to be sort of mutterings and murmurings that, oh, we might be able to return to the Republic. So this ideal of the Republic actually outlives the Republic itself.
Interesting. We're down to sort of our final 5 minutes here. Are there any women you want to talk about specifically that I didn't ask about? You're the expert on this.
Well, I think there's just, I've done sort of over 200 women, I think, are in the books. There are so many astonishing names who I just, you know, I actually hadn't come across many of these women before, despite studying classics all of my life. One in particular who really sort of captured my imagination was Fulvia. And she is a different Fulvia from the one who informed Cicero about the threat to his life. She was a woman who was married to Mark Antony at a time when Mark Antony was having a relationship with Cleopatra. So she was his Roman-born wife, and yet she's always stayed in the shadow. And I like her because the most outrageous things are written about her all through sort of the early part of the Roman Empire and the late Republic as well. I mean, it's said that Cicero was so rude about her during her life that when he was decapitated, she actually got her hairpins and stuck them into his tongue. She was a very sort of politically aware woman. She was waging a war on behalf of Mark Antony while he was with Cleopatra in Alexandria. And we actually have evidence of her within this war, because the site of the war is Perugia in Italy, and there are these amazing little lead bullets, they're slingshot bullets that have been uncovered from that site, and they're inscribed with her name and insults sort of aimed at various parts of her anatomy. And they're so astonishingly rude, and you find these on both sides, but she's clearly there recognised as being an integral part of this war that's going on. And she's someone who I think has lain for too long in the shadow of Cleopatra, who is fascinating in her own right. But I think Fulvia is definitely worthy of being a household name today.
And finally, in just thinking about trying to research women, especially in the ancient world, and ancient world's so difficult, right? Because we only have so many pieces of evidence or writings or archaeological pieces, whatever it is that makes it through time. And then the writings we have to remember that was written by somebody who has their own biases, just like somebody who would be writing today. Do you see the possibility, or are we even moving in an arena in which we can learn more about the past than we could have, say? I mean, I know there's, you know, the sort of DNA aspects and other, you know, scientific things that would allow us to know more about the past than we thought possible before?
I'm hopeful that we are. And I say that because I think with every age, you need to have some new historians coming forward who will look at the sources in a new light, and not even in a sort of concerted way. I feel like naturally, when you read a source, the times you're living in are somehow reflected in the way that you read those sources. And some people say, well, that's a terrible thing. You know, you shouldn't be influenced by your own times. You can't impose our age on the past. And that, I think, you know, that's true to a certain extent. But I also think that in the age we're living in right now, for example, we're very aware of the challenges that women continue to face in the modern world. And the way that women are often written about in the press can be, you know, quite devastating. And we recognize that the way that women have often been treated and continue to be treated today. And I think we either therefore look at the ancient sources with fresh sensitivity. So I think it's partly that, and it's partly the fact that we have got developments, we're able to read more material that we hadn't read before. This is like the one good use, as I see it, of AI. Today, we've got people actually digitally unwrapping, is the phrase we use, these amazing charred scrolls from the site of Herculaneum, which were burned in the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79. So we've got source material, which is potentially coming to us afresh, that hasn't been read for thousands of years. And these things are being read for the first time now. So I think there's hope of finding new material and being able to analyze it, I think, with greater sensitivity than was necessarily the case in the 19th century, for example.
How, I mean, I don't know if you know, but how are they doing that? How, is it just they recognize that they could take some evidence and just from other evidence sort of piece it together in a way that we couldn't do before?
It's with the digital unwrapping. I think it's technical wizardry. I wish I was a computer minded brain when I sort of read about this. They can. It's almost like doing a scan on the human body. They do it on the scroll, and then they use these programs that they create in order to pick out words. And I think once you've got certain letters and words, you can find those repeated within the same document. And I think the first, there was even a competition that was launched in order to be able to read the first of these scrolls, which was sort of being launched for this particular competition. And the first word that was read was the word purple in Greek, which is quite exciting. You think, gosh, you've got one word, and purple's such an interesting word to come across. I think it fires your imagination immediately. You think of sort of the grandeur of the ancient world, purple being a very sort of regal colour in antiquity. And I think you immediately want to know more. And I think this is where technology is fantastic and exciting. And I think it has a lot to offer, actually, even these very, very ancient materials.
So we may have a whole new body of literature from the ancient world coming our
I'm really hopeful. I mean, a lot of these scrolls are coming from a particular library in a wealthy man's villa in the Bay of Naples. And what's known is that he collected a lot of works of philosophy. So we know from a lot of the other things that he had. So it's very likely that a lot of these scrolls would be philosophical in nature, as opposed to, I don't know, like a brand new unknown play by Euripides, you know, or Sophocles. I mean, that would be so exciting for a classicist like me to come across a play, or even better, some writing by a woman. I think that would be the icing on the cake. You know, I'd be doing a new volume, I think, to this book, and it's just to celebrate that. So we don't know exactly what's there, but that is what makes it so exciting.
Daisy Dunn has been our guest. Again, Daisy Dunn's award-winning classicist, author of the book The Missing Thread, A Woman's History of the Ancient World. Dr. Dunn, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you for taking this time.
Oh, so have I. Thank you so much for having me on.